It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, one of the largest clinical labs in the country has released data on employee drug test results. We'll find out more about the rise in the use of cocaine, meth, marijuana, and other drugs. First, companies can require workers to settle employment disputes through individual arbitration. In a decision affecting an estimated 25 million non-unionized workers around the country, the U.S. Supreme Court yesterday sided with Verona-based Epic Systems and two other employers. The companies prevented workers from using class action litigation to sort out disputes over pay, hours, and other conditions. A group of Epic employees said they were being denied overtime pay they were entitled to. They took legal action to void the arbitration agreements they had signed. The court's five conservatives said that while the policy could be debated, the law is clear. Arbitration agreements mean what they say. The four liberal justices said the ruling will be especially hard on low-wage, vulnerable workers. Steph Tai is an associate professor of law at UW-Madison. Steph, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, is this ruling a big deal? Is this going to have a big impact potentially?
Yeah, one thing that's important to understand is that employees on the job market don't necessarily have much choice. A majority, actually over a majority, of non-union private sector jobs seem to have these kind of clauses in it. So in terms of shopping around, it's difficult to find positions without these arbitration clauses.
And if I sign up, I take a job, I click a box on my online application, or I sign a piece of paper, whatever, that has an arbitration agreement in it. What does that mean for me as an employee? What kind of conditions does it set?
Well, one of the things to know is that each of the arbitration clauses can be different. So they can sort of be a broad arbitration clause where you pretty much waive all rights to go to court for many different reasons, or it can be a narrower one. For instance, I think Uber has just recently decided to not have mandatory arbitration for sexual harassment claims. That said, the sort of broadest arbitration clauses mean that you have to, instead of going to court, you have to go to an arbitrator. And some of the concerns that are raised by both employment advocates and consumer advocates are that arbitration doesn't provide the full-on protection that the court system does. You don't have full discovery, meaning you can't get all the data about what's going on. The companies are actually the employers of the arbitration companies, since they're the ones contracting for these services. And there's oftentimes, these are often confidential. So you can't tell, as an employee, whether or not a company's gone through a lot of negative arbitration decisions. So you can't really tell where to go for, you know, appropriate employment.
And the other commonly used option here is this idea of the class action lawsuit. Can you talk about how that works when not just one employee, but a group of employees try to take a company to court?
Yeah, one of the reasons why class action lawsuits are appealing to employee rights advocates is that a lot of times these kinds of disputes don't involve a lot of money. That is, you know, this, I think each claim for each employee in this situation was pretty much like $1,000. The type of work that it takes for an attorney to actually raise this claim on behalf of an employee is often, you know, it often involves many, many hours of work. And so it's often very difficult for employees to find attorneys that will represent them, because cost-benefit-wise, it's just not going to be fruitful for an attorney to spend numbers of hours for just this sort of small amount of money. And so class actions allow all of these sorts of claims to be grouped together into a single umbrella, making it more worthwhile for attorneys and thus making it more easy for employees to find attorneys that are willing to represent them in these sorts of claims.
So if I'm an attorney, say, and I see one client who says, hey, I got shorted $3,000 in overtime, I'm going to charge more than $3,000 probably to represent them. If there are 1,000 employees, then maybe it's worth everybody's time to hire that attorney.
Exactly.
So what does this mean, this ruling mean, that we're going to see fewer class action lawsuits by employees?
Well, especially if the cases, as I mentioned before, about 56% of non-union private sector employees operate under these conditions, under the Supreme Court decision, they're automatically not going to be able to raise these claims because they've already signed it away in their contracts. Moving forward, one thing arguably that employees can do is they can either renegotiate their existing contracts, or they can go through and seek employment at places that don't have these arbitration clauses. But like you said, you know, it's going to be a limited amount of choice that they have.
And this could be, some people have been saying this could be an incentive for more employers to put these arbitration clauses in their employee handbooks because the U.S. Supreme Court has said, yep, we're going to honor that.
Exactly. And there's an additional complication. And so I don't come at any of this from a sort of employment labor law background, but I do have some expertise in contracts. And one thing that a lot of these contracts, these employment contracts have, is also confidentiality agreements. So a lot of times these clauses, these employment contracts, aren't even available to the public. So if you're, say, a random person looking for a job, you won't know going into the job before interviewing and stuff like that, whether or not that employer will have an arbitration clause in their agreement. And so it's hard in terms of choice on the behalf of the employee to necessarily know until you get to that position where you've finally interviewed, gone through the process, gotten the job, and then you have this sort of take it or leave it. And you can't even disclose necessarily to others that this employer is using arbitration clauses.
But the argument from the conservative majority in the Supreme Court is still, you've gone through that process, you've seen the arbitration clause, you've signed that contract, so you have to honor that contract.
Yeah, and this is where the sort of statutory interpretation element comes in, because this is actually a complicated case involving two different statutes. One was the Federal Arbitration Act, which was passed in the 1920s, and the other is National Labor Relations Act, which was passed in 1935. Now, the FAA, Federal Arbitration Act, was initially designed because courts were not at all actually enforcing arbitration agreements. And so this gave some weight to arbitration agreements, or shorthand. The National Labor Relations Act, however, was passed in the sort of New Deal era, guaranteeing more employee rights. And the question became before the Supreme Court is which act sort of basically governs this case. And that's where the sort of majority and the dissent disagree, because it's not simply about whether or not to give weight to these agreements. It's about whether or not the National Labor Relations Act, through its language of protecting, let me look at the language, other collective activities for the purposes of collective bargaining or other mutual aid protection, whether or not that specifically prohibits the sort of enforcement of these arbitration agreements.
Talking to Steph Tighe, Associate Professor of Law at UW-Madison, looking at yesterday's U.S. Supreme Court ruling on arbitration in workplaces. So let me see if I'm following that, Steph. With the National Labor Relations Act, it says, hey, workers, you do have a right to certain kinds of collective action. The argument from the minority in the Supreme Court is you can't sign away those rights that are guaranteed under the National Labor Relations Act. These contracts, these arbitration contracts, don't override these protections. That's their argument?
Yeah, and that the class actions themselves fall under the category of other corrective actions for the purposes of collective bargaining or mutual aid or protection.
Some people have brought up the Me Too movement and issues of sexual harassment and are concerned that this ruling might also make it difficult for women in particular in workplaces to report sexual harassment, to file class action lawsuits. Do you see that as a possible outcome of this decision?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting part, because I do think it's a possible outcome. I tend to be kind of a legal realist in the sense that, you know, that the Supreme Court is probably going to have to weigh in on this, and it'll depend on, you know, what the particular justices' individual takes on this is. However, if you look at the dissent, there's this really interesting part where Ginsburg specifically says, no, I do not interpret this as applying to sexual harassment. And so kind of trying to maybe avoid having the majority's reasoning apply to sexual harassment suits in the future. And so I expect that if any court has to deal with this in the future, they're going to cite that language in Ginsburg dissent.
A lot of these class action lawsuits, including the ones in the Epic case, relate to what people call wage theft, to not getting paid overtime, that kind of thing. Some of these things would be in violation of federal law. It might seem weird to people to say, okay, these arbitration contracts limit your options in dealing with your employer's violation, as you see it, of federal, I don't know if it's civil law, I guess not criminal law. Is that part of the story here?
That's kind of the story. It wasn't full on raised in this particular case. And also, here's where I just admit lack of expertise. I'm not a labor and employment lawyer. So there's probably details that I'm missing on that front.
And if it ended up in criminal behavior, like certain kinds of sexual harassment, sexual discrimination might enter into, I don't know, can that override these arbitration clauses then?
Yeah, because a prosecutor can always bring a claim. The arbitration is about pretty much the employee versus the employer. But the prosecutors are not party to these agreements, and so they can raise any kind of claims they want. The same thing goes when you're asking about sort of violation of federal law. Any kind of federal agency or even a state sort of employment agency can still raise claims because they're not parties to these agreements.
And I want to talk about how much changes. I mean, have courts generally said, oh, well, we've got this arbitration agreement signed by the employer and the employee. We're going to respect that. Was it working this way even before the Supreme Court ruling yesterday?
Well, it was mixed before the circuits, which is why the Supreme Court granted cert. Usually the Supreme Court doesn't grant cert unless there's sort of what they call a circuit split. So different circuits were reaching different conclusions on the employee front. Now, from the general arbitration kind of front, though, the Supreme Court has kind of signaled in recent years that it's heading towards sort of a broader enforcement of arbitration agreements in general under the Federal Arbitration Act, because there's been two big cases, AT&T Mobility versus Concepcion and American Express versus Italian Colors, that dealt with arbitration agreements in the consumer context and, you know, whether or not class action lawsuits can be raised. And for those, they sort of said, yes, well, the Federal Arbitration Act plays a strong role.
I wanted to ask about that consumer angle, because when we click that user agreement for the website or the software, or when we buy a product that has the fine print or something like that, there might be that arbitration clause there that affects me as a consumer. Does this Supreme Court ruling on employee arbitration clauses, does that affect me not as an employee, as a consumer?
Well, they've already said that it does, not in this case, but in two earlier cases, the cases I mentioned, AT&T Mobility versus Concepcion, American Express versus Italian Colors. So they've already said that. So that's why, in some ways, this particular case, the Epic case, wasn't a complete surprise, because the court was already headed that way in terms of consumer actions.
And briefly, Steph, as we wrap up, I mean, is the contract world, the workplace world, different today than it was yesterday before that ruling?
It was, because I think at least employee advocates were hoping that the Supreme Court wouldn't apply the Federal Arbitration Act to these kinds of class action agreements to sort of litigate, because it fell under the National Labor Relations Act. And so now this sort of possibility has been removed.
Steph, thanks a lot for joining us today.
No problem. Glad to talk to you.
Steph Tai is an associate professor of law at UW-Madison. We talked about yesterday's U.S. Supreme Court decision that says companies can require workers to accept individual arbitration clauses.